sights to show you.
Works for me. But yeah, normally 60% dead inside.
Normally.
No, normally 40%. 60% is today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just with us talking and me feeling better.
That helps out.
Yeah, because when I was
better,
in the car, it was 75%.
Oh, no.
I needed the 25% to drive. Safely.
Well, you're right. You needed the 25% so you didn't drive into oncoming traffic.
Yeah, which is hard on the freeway, but I was thinking about, like, well, if we could just go through the cones.
especially the commute from your place to my place, because there's all that construction. So it's just like... the desire to just like...
I
get it.
And especially after seeing this fucking movie, because really,
whatever. Whatever. We'll get into it.
Yep.
So now is probably a good place to get started.
I agree.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. I am your host, Alex Webster. And as always, I am joined by my wonderful co-host. He's at 60% depression levels. His name's Anthony Fuentes. How you feeling?
Hey, and again, normally I'm at 40%, so, you know, it's just a flip today. It happens.
You know what? Sometimes it'd be like that.
It'd be like that.
So, today we are talking about the 1972 film...
Yes, that's
Blackula.
Right. Blackula.
Blackula. Most people either are very, very familiar with this movie or have never heard of it and think it sounds... awful.
I mean, I feel like the name's really cool, though.
It's a cool name, but it also sounds like a B-list horror film name with a...
Which it is. It totally is.
But it has a serious premise.
Yeah, that's true, huh?
Like, the content is pretty serious. Like, it's not, like, poking fun at itself. It's like a B-list horror film trying to take itself a little bit too seriously.
Yeah, in parts. Because it still has the restrictions of a B-list film.
Yeah.
Which is, like, an interesting way of, like... It's a hybrid.
You're right, and we'll get into that as well. So,
all
right,
and then for the synopsis here, we have ourselves, again, IMDb, actually not being too terrible this time because he is an African prince. So, an African prince turned into a vampire by Dracula himself finds himself in modern Los Angeles.
Which, by the way, that beginning aspect with Dracula, and I was just like, what's going on here?
It's like in the middle of the story.
Well, no, like in the very beginning when Dracula is like, just like... you should take it as an honor that I want to rape your wife.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah.
Fucking what?
Oh, right, because it's set in, like, 17-something.
Right, the very, very beginning when he gets turned into a vampire is because Dracula is just like...
He's like, you people mean nothing to me, please.
Yeah, and he's just like, excuse me? You invited me here, and now you're just like...
Like, motherfucker, I'm a prince.
Yeah, like, I'm just like, this dude is just like, do you know who I am?
Yeah.
But
then, you know, it's Dracula.
Right, it's fucking Dracula. So, like, name recognition, I'm gonna have to give it to Dracula.
Yeah, that's a good point. Although, Blackula, again, good name.
It's a good name, but it's a B-horror name, no doubt.
Oh, yeah, and starts with B, too. Bam. but this one's directed by William Crane, written by Joan Torres
and Raymond Cohen.
Interesting. It stars William Marshall, who's actually really fucking cool, and then a bunch of other actors who I don't really know, but let's just try to give their names a go here. Vonetta McGee. Yes. Denise Nicholas,
McGee.
Gordon Pinsett, Charles McCauley.
Yeah.
And then Thalmas Razulala. I like that name. That's a good one.
That's a good name
right there. I'm going to name some character in whatever script I need to write myself out of this depression. Thalmas.
Thalmas is good. So, the box office for this film, the budget was about $500,000, and that's the estimated budget. So, especially, I mean, in 1972, like, that's still, like, it's pretty low budget.
Yeah, it's still more than Halloween, though.
Yeah, that's true.
That's insane.
You just keep coming back to Halloween.
It's more than Black Christmas also. Bam. I come back to all kinds of budgets here.
Yeah. We're a budget focused podcast.
Yeah, right.
We're a finance podcast. No.
We are very poor.
So the budget, $500,000 estimated, and it was released on July 26th, 1972.
Oh shit.
Yeah. And its gross USA earnings is a little over $2 million.
Not a bad return on investment.
Mm-hmm. It performed pretty well. But that was because this particular time in the 70s, we were seeing a little subgenre called blaxploitation.
Well, we're seeing exploitation rise, and then with it comes a lot of little subgenres, and blaxploitation is a big one because of the whole civil rights shit happening, or just prior to this, which we're actually going to get into. So as a, heads up here. This podcast today is going to be a lot about Willie Marshall and blaxploitation because this is a pretty important genre, actually. And again, continuing with the theme of the month. So this is our excuse to dive into it. And of course, Blackula is the horror variant of this genre. And it's actually pretty fundamental.
So fuck it up,
Fontes. Let's do it. Let's go ahead and go into it. So in the early 70s, it was a time of turmoil. Vietnam was a very contentious topic with the My Lai massacre fresh in the public's mind, and also the contentiousness of civil rights movement was far from settled, as racists around the country recoiled at the expanded rights of black citizens.
And no!
like that stopped.
Oh, no!
And then let's remember, too, this is prior to Watergate, so national nightmares were not in short supply at this time, I can tell you that for sure. But this, you know, in this early 70s, tastes began to change in Hollywood due to just how things were nationally. And genres such as musicals in particular were in a huge fucking decline.
See, I love this. And, you know, you talk about this with horror a lot, but, like, horror and just film in general is a huge representation about what's going on in that country at the time. Like, especially if you're just thinking through, like, an American lens, which I know we, like, never do. But, like, if you're thinking, like, classic horror in, like, the 60s and how, like, invasion films because of Cold War stuff were, like, on the rise. Or, like, you know, post 9/11 torture porn became a huge thing. Like, all of that. I think it's just so interesting, the reflection of national temperaments in film.
Yeah, like what catches the public's eye? Yeah. And you're like, oh, we're gonna, it's Hollywood still like a fucking virus. So it's working. We're gonna keep doing this now.
Because what films can we make that are going to yield well?
And how benign can we make this message while still claiming we can send the message?
Yeah, exactly.
Although in the 70s, you had no choice. You had to send these messages. That's just how it was. But again, audiences were looking for something new. But the Hollywood change is actually really slow in Hollywood, and it tends to get pretty stuck in its ways, even though there's turmoil and scandal, whatever it is. Hollywood doesn't want to change what they think works. Not what works, what they think works.
Right, and that makes sense also, because it takes a long fucking time to make a movie.
Mm-hmm. No, that's true.
You know, they're always kind of, you know, it's very hard to anticipate trends in films.
Good point. Prior to 1971, if you were to tune into TV or find your way to a cinema and saw a black character on screen, they were most likely a sidekick or a victim. Black filmmakers had a very hard time making their way into the Hollywood system and doing it in a way that didn't hamstring their work.
Right.
So, like, if they were even going to get a chance to direct wherever it is, it was just like, well, you could do this, like, fucking Mickey Mouse project over there if you're going to be in this at all. So, again, civil rights and all this stuff happened, but in terms of people actually taking action, very, very slow.
And, you know, it's like one of those things where it's like, they didn't, like, it's not like, well, people did not, were under the impression that they couldn't just, like, flip a switch and be like, okay, suddenly...
Yeah, racism's gone.
Yeah, or, like, black people are people, you know? Like, that kind of thing wasn't, like, people were... It was very hard to get them to navigate out of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's hard to get rid of ingrained biases, basically.
Well, these ingrained... biases...
Biases, yay!
These biases are still... These biases are still alive and well today.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you see this all the time, especially in, like, buddy cop films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you're seeing black people being used as a sidekick.
Yeah.
Constantly. It's still a very common trope.
Yeah. I mean, these people did raise children, so.
Right.
Yeah. But B-movies and grindhouse films at the time did not have the same restrictions or standards as the mainstream Hollywood film and television productions.
Ooh.
And they had a fucking audience. These things were on the rise. And we've covered this before in stuff like, you know, Black Christmas and Halloween, like we just talked about minutes ago.
Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
This is all, you know, they're all relics
episode
of a time.
Episode 2.
If you we can name all the episodes, but just look at our backlog.
I honestly probably couldn't at this point. This is, 21?
Yeah, I think so. Episode 10, though, we covered this stuff tremendously in The Evil Dead.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Okay. I totally forgot we did Evil Dead.
Right? It actually got a few views this week. Oh, we're back to this stuff. But again, if you reference that episode, if you look back at that one, we'll go into how there was really no oversight for this kind of stuff, which allowed different types of films to be made, which is nice. But in this time, a filmmaker named Melvin Van Peebles. Melvin Van Peebles. Remember that? Because he wanted to make the first Black Power film.
I love his name.
Yes. He's a pretty prolific guy. Because Van Peebles had made a name for himself with his short films, which premiered in France after he shot them around Hollywood for a while in an attempt to get a director gig. No one in Hollywood would hire him, but Europe was welcoming to him. Teaching himself French and coming off a dissolved marriage, Van Peebles began to make a name for himself as a writer and eventually was able to make his first feature film, The Story of a Three-Day Pass, La Permission.
I'm pretty sure that's French.
Yeah.
And you put, like, I put my a Spanish flair
that, that's
onto
how
it.
I know when I read it. That was in 1968, though, so pretty much in civil rights time. This attracted the attention of some Hollywood producers, securing himself a studio film with Columbia Pictures. The Hollywood producers thought he was actually a French auteur, and boy, were those motherfuckers wrong.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, we're going to get this French guy who can speak English really well, and blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, he's a blackie, darn. So Van Peebles finally has his chance to make a film, and the film he makes is called Watermelon Man. And was about a bigoted white insurance salesman who wakes up one day as a black man. It was inspired by Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, which have you read?
Oh my goodness, no.
Oh, it's fucking brutal.
You know, it's funny. There's also a gender theory or like a feminist film theory film called Watermelon Woman.
Huh.
And it's a mockumentary, actually.
Interesting.
Well, it's kind of like a pseudo-mockumentary. It's about this woman trying to find this other woman in history, like this, like, and it's just like, it's a very interesting, like, feminist film. So I think, obviously, I'm pretty sure it's a nod to this because it's about like blackness and stuff. I live in an apartment complex and it's right against a line of houses.
Mm.
So if you hear a dog barking, it's not my fault. I promise. It's my neighbors, and I can't control that.
There's different, like, hazards for each recording place, because I have a band upstairs.
Have a band upstairs, and you have active roommates.
Yeah, that's true.
DJ and my one roommate, so it's a little bit easier to just be like, hey, shut up.
But during the making of Watermelon Man, there was a lot of contention between Van Peebles and screenwriter Herman Raucher. But this taught Melvin that he needed absolute creative control over his work if he was to make the Black Power film he so desired.
Very cool.
Good thing for him, though. Watermelon Man was a financial success. And Columbia offered Melvin Van Peebles a 3-picture fucking deal. But he turned it down in order to make his own fully realized Black Power film.
This is a man who knows what he wants, and he's just like, fuck you guys, I'm doing what I want.
He's actively fighting the system. Mm-hmm. He's like, I could become part of the system, or I can do this shit on my own because I believe in my fucking philosophy. So with his own money and a $50,000 loan from Bill Cosby, that didn't age well. Fucking 81 in prison now, Jesus. Van Peebles wrote, directed, edited, scored, starred, and co-produced his groundbreaking feature film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, shot over 19 fucking days.
Excuse me, badass.
Badass song. Van Peebles did all his own stunt work, was featured in numerous unsimulated sex scenes, and hired his son Mario Van Peebles to play a young Sweetback.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, he unsimulated sex scenes. Melvin actually got gonorrhea from one of the sex scenes in the film.
Oh my god.
This is the early 70s. This is the transition point between free love 60s and the world's fucking crazy
that
70s.
I mean, horrifying. Although gonorrhea, like, everyone gets gonorrhea at some point. Like, it's very common.
Oh, that's horrible. But yes.
Like, if they even think you may potentially have gonorrhea, they're like, here, take these horse pills.
Mm-hmm.
Just in case.
And just in case.
Like, what?
But because of this, he was able to get workman's comp, actually, from the gonorrhea thing.
How do you get workman's comp it from Connery?
Because okay, he was injured on the job.
It
yeah.
was the 70s. I understand, but literally now, it's literally two pills and that's it. You're done. You yep. no longer have gonorrhea. It's but, gone. Or is that chlamydia?
I'm not even sure. I have not had either so far.
I haven't either. I'm just like, hmm. Yeah.
But he did get workman's comp, and which he actually promptly put back into the production budget of the film.
Mm.
Yeah, so he's just thinking about the dollar right there.
I mean, handy.
Yeah. This was released in April of 1971. So Sweet Sweetback's badass song was actually unlike anything that had come before it. And black audiences were fucking blown away by how bold this film was. Because in this film, there was a black man was actively fighting against the system. And in the end, he came out on top.
Nice.
Which, you know, if this kind of film typically was made around the time, it stays victimhood. It's all victimhood up until this point. And now it's like, no, you have a fucking hero. It's fucking Sweetback, son. But the film was rated X due to the sex scenes. And Van Peebles used this for his tagline, which is rated X by an all-white jury.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah.
I love that.
The film was a financial hit, of course, and it became a cultural touchstone, with Spike Lee later saying that Sweet Sweetback's badass song gave us the answers we needed. This was an example of how to make a film, a real movie, distribute it yourself, and most importantly, get paid.
Nice.
Yep. And with the success of Melvin Van Peebles' film, MGM decided to take a stab at the genre as they were fledgling to be relevant in New Hollywood and needed something to put them back on the map. Now, only a few months after the release of Sweet Sweetback and on the verge of bankruptcy, MGM released Gordon Parks' Shaft. This film saved MGM from going under, as it made more than $13 million on a $500,000 budget.
So, if this had failed, there would be no MGM.
No, there wouldn't be. There absolutely wouldn't be. Shaft saved MGM.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. So, blaxploitation has a very, very important part in film history.
So, basically, black people saving the day and then not getting the credit
definitely not getting the credit for it, which we'll cover further down in the history here. But interestingly enough, Shaft actually won an Academy Award for MGM 2 for Best Original Song, as well as numerous Grammy nominations. So not only did it save them from bankruptcy, it gave them fucking prestige.
Wow.
In a time when it was okay to pick the side of black people during civil rights, because obviously it was contentious a decade before that. Now it's just like, this is the right side, and we're going to make a film, and yeah. So,
this is the right side.
We're doing it, guys! New Hollywood! With MGM was back on the map, black filmers finally had influence in Hollywood, and the genre of blaxploitation was born. But what are the characteristics of blaxploitation here, Miss Alex Wester? Because there's, you know, we talk about it, but and obviously if you see this film, you'll see it in there.
Right.
But there are some very defining characteristics that actually meld pretty interesting with horror, because horror has a lot of B-movies anyways. So would you let us know?
Yeah. So some of the characteristics of blaxploitation, which I actually have never seen a blaxploitation film before this. So this is my first ever experience with it.
I've actually seen some of Sweet Sweetback.
Oh, okay.
And there are a couple others just randomly.
Yeah, no, I haven't. So I'm not even super familiar about what really classifies a film as a blaxploitation film. But with the successes of Sweet Sweetback and Shaft, certain genre conventions were established in regards to blaxploitation. Here are some of those conventions.
There we go.
Blaxploitation films are often seen in two distinct settings: the poor urban neighborhoods of the Northeast or West Coast, or the Deep South, mainly during the antebellum era with a focus on slavery. Shock value and provocation are also a main tenet of the genre, more specifically by means of the drug trade, sex, and violence, alongside, let's say, some colorful language, especially when regarding the white characters. You will hear the word honky at least once in a blaxploitation film.
Oh, yeah. Or if you hang out with me all the goddamn time.
You never say it. Oh, yeah, you do.
You don't hear it.
Interesting. No. Anthony's talking shit about me behind my back, guys.
Yes, my podcast partner. Man, I really love working with that honky.
Oh. I'm so offended. No,
Own it!
The other word you'll hear a lot in a blaxploitation film is the man.
Mm-hmm.
As a big focus of the genre is that black protagonists are fighting against systems of oppression established by the white majority, particularly those that have actively oppressed the black community. which is important.
Mm-hmm. Looking at you, job creators.
Looking at you, Duke whatever whatever from...
Duke Medgar.
Duke Medgar, yeah.
From Tales from the Hood, from that's
Tales
right.
From the Hood. Something else you might see is Black political and social issues being front and center of the genre. This is primarily motivated from the Black Power movement that started in the 60s. Melvin Van Peebles' goal of creating the first Black Power film and the mainstream appeal of Shaft. So.
Yeah. That's good. Good. So there, stuff to draw from, yeah.
Yeah, no.
It's a good foundation.
Yeah, totally. And then you also see the look of films in blaxploitation as a genre is also a major characteristic. So how they film it, and they're usually pretty cheap to make and employ the use of inexpensive camera equipment, which coupled with an urban setting adds a distinct layer to the film's aesthetics, which you know how I feel about aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
This is primarily due to Sweet Sweetback's use of two different and conflicting lighting setups for indoor shots that gave an unseen hue to the picture. It actually impressed the cinematographer of Sweetback, who initially was against Van Peebles' idea of using two different light settings.
Yeah.
So I love this, because one of the things that I noticed when I was watching Blackula was the lighting, mm-hmm. and I actually really enjoyed it. That and the music, but we'll get into
that. Oh, fuck yeah.
Another defining aspect of the genre is its music.
Mm-hmm.
Right there. I did not.
You will get to that. It's the next fucking line.
Thanks to the success of Sweetback, most of the film utilize a funk, soul, or jazz score that shies away from mainstream hits of their respective genres. The music is complex, features heavy bass, and will also occasionally employ the use of an orchestra or orchestral instruments for certain scenes. I love this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in Blackula, the music, and I'm not a huge 70s music fan. Like, I don't... Like,
oh, I'm a huge 70s
music
fan.
I know you
fan,
are.
Yeah.
I'm not. Like, any of this kind of stuff, I'm just like... Not, it's not my thing, but like DJ and I were just like,
oh yeah, it's funky.
Yeah.
And you know, the orchestral beats are kind of nice too. Mm-hmm. I just remember thinking when I was done with it, I'm like, yeah, movies, whatever. But I put in my notes, find Blackula soundtrack.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good place to be. But though the primary settings for blaxploitation films are either urban or southern in focus, there are several subgenres explored within it. They can range from crime dramas, such as Foxy Brown, comedies, such as Uptown Saturday Night, martial art films, like Three the Hard Way, and of course, horror, which has the landmark 1972 film Blackula.
Mm-hmm.
Blackula was a huge success for its time and helped expand the blaxploitation genre. Even further, though, a lot of that success can be credited to the actor playing the title role, William Marshall.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony?
It's kind of interesting because I watched an hour and a half interview with William Marshall because, unfortunately, he suffered Alzheimer's towards the end of his life.
Oh, no.
So, and the interview was done by his daughter, who I think wanted to get, like, his philosophies and basically, like, capture his intelligence right. on camera, so you know, as a contributor to as a, you know, to show exactly what kind of man he was, because he is an articulate man, and you'll find out exactly why coming up here. But William Marshall was born on August 19th of 1924 in Gary, Indiana. He attended New York University as an art student, but found himself drawn to theater, ultimately training at the Actors Studio at the American Theater Wing and with Sanford Meisner at the Neighborhood Playhouse. Here are a few people that Sanford Meisner trained throughout his career. This is interesting. So you get Aaron Eckhart, Alec Baldwin, Christopher Lloyd, Christoph Waltz, Diane Keaton, James Caan, James Franco, Jessica Walter, John Turturro, John Voight, Jeff Goldblum, Robert Duvall, Sandra Bullock, Steve McQueen, Tina Fey, and Tom Cruise.
Holy shit!
He trained with one of the fucking best in the entire business.
Who are you thinking?
William Marshall.
Oh, yeah.
Who we're talking about.
Right. Yeah. I thought you were like saying who was the best out of that list.
Oh, God. Who is the best? Who do you think? Goldblum. Yeah. Goldblum!
I was gonna go Goldblum or Bullock.
You know, Bullock's definitely recognizable. But, I mean, Diane Keaton also had a pretty big career,
true, too.
So, yeah. And that's just, like, I couldn't put the whole list there.
Right.
Because there's way more actors he trained. These are the ones where I'm like, we'll know these fuckers.
Worst actor on the list.
Worst actor on the list is James Franco. Okay.
Moving on. We are in agreement. Moving on.
William Marshall was also a trained opera singer, and he has that fucking baritone, so you can definitely sense that shit. But after years of hard work, Marshall made his Broadway debut in Carmen Jones in 1944, and this was an update of the opera Carmen, which had its setting changed from a southern Spain to a World War II African-American setting. And, you know, this coming in 1944, obviously that was very relevant.
Yes.
You know, so theater, as slow as Hollywood is, I feel like other types of art are much faster.
Oh, like theater?
Yeah, yeah. In terms of like, this is an actual issue, and eventually Hollywood's going to make this, but let's just do it.
Yeah.
He then took on leading stage roles in The Green Pastures and William Shakespeare's Othello, and was considered by some critics to be the best actor to take on the role of Othello in generations.
I haven't seen this, but I want to.
Yeah, have you seen O?
No.
It's a take on Othello that's very contemporary.
It okay, stars, yeah.
Josh Hartnett did it, actually.
Oh.
And
yeah,
Mekhi Phifer plays
okay. No, I think that's actually really interesting. I love seeing Shakespeare retellings, even though, like, I don't know. Like, I know it's, like, so pretentious to be like, I really like Shakespeare. Yeah. But, like, I really like retellings of, like, really old shit. I think it's so fun.
What did you think of a weird Shakespeare retelling? 10 Things I Hate About You.
I love 10 Things.
I fucking love 10 Things I Hate About You,
yes. It's one of my favorite movies. I also love Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
You know, Romeo and Juliet, you're right. I like that. I was thinking Great Gatsby. I hate his version of Great Gatsby.
I was kind of indifferent about that. I was also in high school when it came out and we were studying it in my English class because I was like a senior in high school when that movie came out. Mm-hmm. I loved Romeo and Juliet. I love 10 Things I Hate About You. It's such a good movie. It's one of like my
10 Things I Hate About. Oh, it is a Shakespeare one. Yeah. Also, She's All That.
Yeah, because She's All That. And because
She's All That is Pygmalion.
Yeah. And then 10 Things I Hate About You is Taming of the Shrew.
Mm-hmm. Man, 90s had some good shit.
But
this is a horror podcast.
Okay, right, sorry, we're not talking about that's 90s. Right. Coming of age?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The coming of age tales, exactly. But it says, so William Marshall's talent on screen translated actually, or his talent on the stage translated to the screen, as he was cast as the Haitian leader in the 1952 film, Lydia Bailey.
He doesn't get a name.
Yeah. Well, I mean, his broad stature and Shakespearean background made it hard to cast him as in the traditional subservient roles that were offered to black actors at the time. Like, he literally did not fit the fucking bill. And they were like, we have to at least give him a position of authority.
But he doesn't get a name. That he so does get a name.
But,
leader.
Like, you know, you don't fuck with the Haitian leader. You fuck with the Haitian, you know,
army?
Warriors and, yeah, things like that. So he was giving a star role, though, in the 1950s TV series Harlem Detective. It was the first national TV drama or comedy to feature a black actor in a leading role that was not a subservient one. It was a major, major fucking accomplishment. But it was canceled after one season. Why do you think it was canceled after one season? Was it low ratings, Alex?
No, I don't think so. I think it was...
It was that William fucking Marshall was caught up in the Red Scare and accused of being a communist.
What? I love and hate the Red Scare because it's like, it's literally like, you wronged me one time or I just don't like you as a person. You're a communist.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's just like, are you a communist though? Like,
what's this, a powerful black man making an entertainment and setting a standard for young audiences?
Communism.
That's communism, guys. No.
Jesus.
Yeah. Now, there's not a lot of information about what happened after this, but it appears at this point in history, William Marshall's blacklisting did not get nearly as much buzz as whoever accused him wanted it to. So his blacklist ended up being temporary. And he was back to getting regular acting work, though it is a blemish. But yeah, he actually said something very, very particular about this whole being accused of being a communist thing. I actually just forgot to put it in here, but he was not happy about that at all. Like, he was basically saying, like, dude, like, I am being targeted. Like, this isn't the communism thing or whatever it is. This isn't about my beliefs. I'm literally being targeted.
Because I'm black.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But in 1965, he was actually at Los Angeles during the riots. Mm-hmm. He had just been in L.A. for only a few months. But in the aftermath of the Watts riots of the 1960s, he went to the Happening Coffee House and taught classes to affected black youth of the riots. So as a way of healing the neighborhood, he created this class for people who wanted to learn how to act. properly, Shakespearean was, you know? And he was taught by Strauss.
Training. Right, yeah.
So, like, the dude is contributing tremendously. And while he dominated the stage, he had not had a breakout role, really, in film or television. That was taken away from him. This is until Marshall was cast, though, in the 1972 hit film Blackula, which we're talking about right fucking now.
I'm
Let's
so
do
glad
it.
We went, like, with the same inflection. Yeah.
we do this every goddamn week.
We're used to each other
yes,
at
that's
this
true.
Point. No, since Blaxploitation was becoming so profitable, studios were rushing fast to produce as many of them as possible. Which, you know, we see. This has happened with superhero films.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
This happens. Or specifically with comic films.
Mm-hmm.
Or comic book turned to film
and
movies.
And it hasn't stopped.
No,
I mean, like...
no, it is still going on. I am tired. I as someone who was not allowed to watch horror as a child,
mm-hmm.
but did not like dramas or comedies or
yeah, you really pigeonholed yourself that one
I
there.
I did. So I ended up watching about as many action-adventure films as I could get my hands
right.
on. Or, like, thrillers.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, like, the little tiny allowances that my mom was like, sure.
Yeah, you can...
Even though she didn't let me watch Seven until I was 18.
Well, Seven's pretty fucked up, though.
You know what's so funny is I watched it, and I texted my mom later after I'd watched it, and I was like, you really made me wait until I had moved out to watch Seven.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, if I had known half of the things that you watched on Criminal Minds, I would have let you watch it a lot sooner. Because Criminal Minds has some fucked up episodes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the one you described them, yes. It sounds... And then even look at it, like the Matthew Lillard one and all that,
yeah,
when you're doing the research, I'm like, yee.
Yeah. So, but she was just like, no, like, you could have watched it so much sooner. I fucked up on that one, and I was like, thank you for admitting that.
See, I know my mom listens to this podcast, and I've told you this story before, but I don't know if the audience have heard this. My mom tried something very similar with The Simpsons.
Oh, no.
Yes, it was...
I don't think you told me the story.
Yeah, it was the Bart Sells His Soul episode.
Yes.
So, because she was very Christian,
mm-hmm.
and it was one of those things where, like, well, you can't watch it because they're talking about the soul and the devil and things like that. And my little mind was like...
I know.
It actually had a moment of protest. Usually I was just like, okay, Mom. But this time I was like, they're going to turn it around. Like, because I had seen The Simpsons enough. But she really tried banning me. But it was one of those weird things where I just didn't listen. And they were not used to that from me. So they were like, well... I guess he's just going to watch The Simpsons now. And I guess he can watch all those scary movies now. Like, all this other... It really, like, broke the ground there. So I credit Bart Sells His Soul with the episode allowing me to actually have a pretty broad swath of stuff I was able to watch as a kid.
That's so
even
cool,
though it was
though.
Pretty benign, mm. like, compared to, like, some of the other shit we used to watch
yeah.
back in the day.
My grandma let my brother watch The Simpsons, and I just didn't like it because I knew I wasn't supposed to be watching it.
Mm-hmm.
So... My grandma loved The Simpsons and King of the Hill.
Oh,
so,
fuck yeah.
So
good times.
Those, like, I actually did enjoy King of the Hill as a kid, but it was just mm-hmm. like one of those things where it was just like, I can't tell my mom about it.
Yeah, that's right. It had that little air of, like, naughtiness to it, I guess.
Yeah, where it's like, and then I would go hide and watch Animal Planet or whatever. Because I did watch a lot of Animal Planet.
Oh, yeah.
As a child, like tiny
very
tiny
visually
child.
Stimulating, yes.
Yes. Moving on. In 1971, there were only two Blaxploitation films with Sweetback and Shaft. In 1972, that number jumped to 9, featuring films such as Trouble Man, Black Mama, White Mama, Across 110th Street, Superfly, the last of which has a soundtrack by Curtis Mayfield.
Fuck, that is an amazing, iconic soundtrack.
I haven't.
Oh, you've probably heard some of the songs on here.
Oh, okay.
Like, literally, if you've heard, like, the most popular ones, you'll recognize it from commercial, you'll recognize it. Like, it's
gotcha.
A very,
it's
very,
very like,
iconic soundtrack.
All right.
Yeah. Curtis Mayfield was the fucking man. Shame what happened to him, but a good fucking guy. The stage fell on him. Broke
oh
his
my
neck.
God.
Yeah.
Stage fell on him?
Part of the top part of the stage that he was singing on, I believe, fell on him during a performance. Yeah, and he broke his neck. Yeah, Curtis, and he was, like, fucking G, dude. Like, his songs were amazing. But, yeah, and he wrote a lot, I think, afterwards for a lot of musicians.
One of these days, yeah. I want to do something about concert tragedies, because...
Oh, that'd be fun.
I know so many.
Horror!
I know so many. Anyway, so the only feature film director William Crane worked on prior to directing Blackula was the 1971 film Brother John, which received terrible reviews. He was an intern.
Yeah.
So, cut him some slack here.
Yeah.
He had also directed an episode of The Mod Squad, which starred Clarence Williams III.
The shit.
yes, the shit.
Refer to our Tales from the Hood episode.
like two weeks ago.
Yes.
Vampire films were in a bit of a low spot right now, as were other monster films at the time. Movies like Last House on the Left were making waves in horror, as opposed to the more traditional horror films. Last House on the Left, of course, being
Wes Craven's feature.
First feature-length film. So.
And I believe Carpenter would later on go on to say horror prior to those kind of films was just costume horror, right?
Right.
Yeah, like Mickey Mouse bullshit.
And then Last House on the Left was just like people
it was like,
being horrible.
How about a whole film around a rape? Like, how about that?
You know what? I watched the remake of this.
Oh, that was much worse.
It was terrifying.
It was so much more graphic than I remembered the first one.
I watched it. Does it have Jennifer Lawrence in it?
Fuck, maybe. It had one of those like young up-and-comers,
though. Yeah. I think it did. But the point is I remember watching it and thinking it was like, I didn't know the context of it. I just knew it was a horror film. And I was like, fuck it. I'm in high school. My mom can't stop me. Watches it. Is in horrified silence.
You're like, this is like a 20-minute rape scene. Jesus.
Yeah. I was just like, what is going on? And I just remember not even really thinking it as a horror film. I just remember thinking it was just like awful.
Yeah. Well, it's a horror exploitation hybrid, basically,
right,
which is what we have right here.
Yeah. And now I'm like super into like exploitation films. Yeah. So it all worked out.
We should do a comparison one down the line. Last House on the Left.
Oh, yeah. We should.
Yeah. We'll do that. You're living up for that. We'll see. If you guys want that, let us know.
Yeah.
A comparison between those two.
Blackula had started production in January of 1972 and it lasted through March. So it was a relatively
short shoot.
Once cast in Blackula, William Marshall asked for a crucial change to the story. He wanted the title character to have some dignity and work closely with the producers to develop a compelling backstory for the character. The original character's name was going to be Andrew Brown, a reference to Amos and Andy. But Marshall convinced the producers to change it to
Mamuwalde.
And add a backstory about him being an African prince who was bitten by Dracula.
Brilliant fucking change, I will say.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, brilliant fucking change.
It was a good call on his part, and I think it added a lot more sustenance to the film.
I mean, the Shakespearean actor has a lot of stuff to say to the former intern.
I mean, really, isn't everyone just a former intern?
That's a good point.
I'm a former intern.
That's true.
I was an intern when you met me.
Yeah, and I was an employee.
Whatever. You weren't my supervisor.
I was. That's right.
It's not like you had to like, well, yeah, no.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Fun times.
Fuck off. The film was shot in Los Angeles, with some scenes being filmed in Watts, specifically. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, good for... He really, like, took Watts under his goddamn Blackula wing right there.
I was wondering, like, I was just like, okay, it's supposed to take place in Los Angeles. And I'm like, they really nailed Los Angeles in the 70s.
Oh, it's in Los Angeles.
And I'm like, oh, they filmed it in Los Angeles in the 70s. That's why they nailed Los Angeles in the 70s. It has been reported that the trailer for Blackula was so popular with black audiences that some people were buying movie tickets to see the trailer alone.
The last time I heard of this happening was for the Phantom Menace trailer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
People
bought tickets to the Waterboy so they can see the Phantom Menace trailer.
That is so unfortunate.
Star Wars fans back in the day. The internet.
But I'm saying The Phantom Menace is not a good movie.
Yeah, good point. I agree.
That's what I'm saying.
But they didn't know that.
I know. But like the trailer must have been like so amazing in comparison to the film.
Oh, the trailer was amazing. This is the first time you hear Duel of Fates.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was, I remember that trailer thing and like the little tiny goosebumps in my little fucking Star Wars nerd's body back in the day.
This film came out in what, 2001? 2002?
Phantom Menace? 1999.
Was it 1999?
2002 was Attack of the Clones.
Yes.
And 2005.
Okay,
was
so 1999, I was 4.
Yeah, see, no, I was 12, I think.
I owned the Phantom Menace on VHS, and that's when I broke my nose because my twin and I were playing Jedi. And I got kneed in the face on accident and broke my nose.
During this time, they released the Star Wars, I think. The original trilogy in theaters like 3 months back to back, and then my parents took me to those, and I saw Star Wars for the first time in theaters. So I became a fucking Star Wars nerd immediately. And then they bought the VHSs. So,
adorable.
No, the hype machine was built around me. And so when Phantom Menace came out, and I was a football player back in the day because everybody was taller than me, or wasn't taller than me yet.
Oh.
Yeah. So I went to see The Waterboy because, you know, I played football.
Waterboy is one of the few
Sandler films
that I can tolerate.
I fucking love The Waterboy.
I enjoy it.
I fucking love The Waterboy. All right, back to Blackula.
Sorry.
Sorry, that was both our faults.
Blackula was released in theaters during the rise of blaxploitation films and was very financially successful, enough so that a sequel was being put into production almost immediately. William Marshall's performance was highly praised, and Blackula made him an icon. When talking about the character and its effect on his life, he says, and I quote, "I dare say the vast majority of people don't go to the theater, so I don't mind that I'm still so strongly identified with Blackula. I did enjoy Blackula to a great extent. Early on, young black people who didn't know my name would yell at me on the street,
Mama Walde.
Mama Walde. Hey, Mama Walde. It was especially pleasing that I was being called by the African name I gave the character. I asked one young fan, who do you think I am? He said, quoting from the nightclub scene, you know, you're the strange dude.
I remember the guy that said that in the nightclub scene.
Yeah.
I don't know, but he's one strange dude.
You're the strange dude. I think that's adorable.
Right. He was an icon. And
right.
Honestly, like, if you listen to like music from like the Fugees and stuff in the 90s, Blackula's referenced in a lot of media.
Is it?
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
sure. Like, here's the thing. It's like, I've heard of it before I even did anything. Like, before we even decided to cover it. Like, I've heard of it. I just considered it. Like, I was just like, it's probably, like, a super cheesy, awful B-list horror film. And it's surprisingly serious.
Yeah. Oddly serious.
Which I think has something to do with William Marshall's intervention in the film.
Yeah, because if you look at William Crane's stuff, no.
Yeah.
No.
However, not everyone was a fan of Blackula. Beverly Hills Hollywood branch NAACP president Julius Griffin supported Mexican-American actor Anthony Quinn's proposed portrayal of black Haitian hero King Christoph and called Marshall's portrayal of Blackula demeaning. His constituency forced him to resign.
I'm a representative of the NAACP and the black community, and I don't think... Sorry, buddy. Mama Walde, son.
Yeah. In this house, we only support Blackula.
Yeah. You picked wrong.
Blackula won the first ever Best Horror Film Award at the 1972 Saturn Awards, and William Marshall was given an award for his performance in Blackula by the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, originally known as the Count Dracula Society.
Aww.
Which is awesome.
I like that.
William Marshall reprised his role as Blackula in 1973's Scream, Blackula, Scream, which has been called by some the, quote, worst blaxploitation film of all time.
Damn.
Which is rough.
Yeah, big dichotomy between the two.
William Marshall would continue to act on stage, garnering major praise for 1983's Frederick Douglass, The Slave and Statesman. Marshall would later teach acting at the University of California, Irvine, as well as African American Arts and Music Institution in Watts. He passed away on June 11th, 2003, at the age of 78. As we already said, from Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Alzheimer's and I believe diabetes are the two things that got him.
Yeah, which sucks. But also, that's cool that he taught at UCI.
Yeah, right? It's cool. He taught at UCI. And man, if you hear this guy talk in interviews, like, this is an eloquent motherfucker. Like, he was straight up like, he taught himself French. Like, he taught himself to go to Europe and actually fucking did it. So yeah, this guy's a fucking baller, man. But of course, blaxploitation wouldn't really last, unfortunately. Yeah, it had a pretty big decline. So the appeal of blaxploitation followed the trend of other exploitation-based films in that while it was popular for a time, its decline was incredibly fucking steep. By 1976, over 200 blaxploitation films had been made, and they weren't merely limited to independent studios. Stars started...
200?
Yeah, 200 by 1976. Remember, the first year... It's two, then it's nine, and then it
and
just keeps
just
getting
like
more.
Exponentially.
Yeah, exponentially,
growing.
Exactly. Stars started coming out of the genre, though, particularly Pam Grier and Fred Williamson. Pam Grier's fucking awesome. And Fred Williamson, too. I like when I see him and stuff. But the genre itself was running out of ideas and facing increasing backlash from the NAACP. So while Blackula got free pass.
Yeah, what's his face familiar is like, oh, so now you want to be critical? Yeah. Huh? Now you want to be critical?
But I feel like it was one of those things where, like, hey, you can talk all that shit about the genre, but Blackula's cool. The NAACP criticized films released within the genre more and more, with a particular focus on the negative stereotypes perpetuated regarding Black Americans. And I believe it was the negative stereotypes created by white audiences at the time. So they were like, you're just basically supporting their messages to us by putting these stereotypes in your film. Audiences were also growing tired of the lack of variation between Blaxploitation films. And as the 80s came near, there were far less films in the genre than in the early 70s. Upon the arrival of the new decade, there was almost no Blaxploitation films in production.
This had such a fast rise and fall. It's really interesting.
It seems maybe it could be systemic. I don't know.
Well, no, I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about, like, why that is. Because, like, for...
Exploitation as a genre was a big rise and fall. So what really I think is because it's something we're going to get into later on this month, or next month, actually. Different types of exploitation took over as it went along. So Blaxploitation, while prominent in its time, still kind of suffered from lack of variation. Yeah. And then something totally new came up, which, I forgot, Mondo Films was one of them, too. And then stuff like the Midnight Movie and whatever it was, like, that all kind of took over. So you missed some of the exploitation audience, and the Black audience, I don't think, was enough to support the genre. Thus, kind of splintered off.
Well, I think it's kind of interesting because you also... Like, you see this in horror, where, like, once you oversaturate a genre or a subgenre, people get tired of it.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, they're just, like, they move on. And so you see that with a lot of those subgenres where they have their decade, where they are incredibly prominent and incredibly popular, and they have, like, kind of, like, their golden years, and then after that, it's just so subpar that it's unfortunate.
Yeah, and then I feel like there's also a lack of really prominent ones to come out. Like, the most of the names you see in the Blaxploitation list are from the early part. Because it went from 2 to 205 years.
That is ridiculous.
That's Hollywood basically trying to drown this bitch.
Yeah.
That's what I feel
like. It's everyone trying to cash in on the success of Blaxploitation films, and which is unfortunate because it also ends up leading to a lot of, you know, there's a flood of content, and then everyone, you know, you can't expect the same, you know, group of, like, several million people to see the same film 200 times and pay for it.
Not only that, I didn't put this in my notes, but from when I was reading on the history of this stuff, the decline put Black filmmakers out of Hollywood for a while. Like, because that's what they were giving Black filmmakers. Oh, you're going to make a Blaxploitation film,
which
you can move on to something
ridiculous,
else.
Which is also ridiculous, because it's like, you can't, like, it's just like, you're Black, you can make you can just make the Black people movies.
Yeah, only 10 years from civil rights. So, yeah, that's how it was back then, unfortunately. While they give Spielberg and everybody free fucking, and Landis, like, free reign.
John Landis, fuck
free
you, John
fucking
Landis.
Reign. Yeah, and then, of course, these movies are making so much more times their budget, yet. You're like, oh, well, there's not an audience for this anymore, so maybe, sorry, buddy.
So, I mean, and also, I know I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but, like, would you say that then the 90s to, like, probably now, so the last, 30 years or so, a response to Blaxploitation would be, like, Black comedies, quote-unquote?
Okay. That's actually coming up in... Keep reading.
Oh, okay.
That's so literally sorry. like two segments away.
Okay.
So, yes.
So, okay, I was just curious. So
your answer's coming right fucking now.
Please.
Oh, right. The genre would, of course, be lampooned in 1988 with I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker, directed by Keenan Ivory Wayans. But with this film, Blaxploitation was less seen as a relic and more as a cultural touchstone. So this brought Blaxploitation back, but with an added change to it. It's like, listen, we're not going to make a Blaxploitation film. We're going to use Blaxploitation elements and talk about it and make our own film. And it was a comedy film. It was a Wayans comedy film. So the Wayans brothers are very, very much influenced by this kind of stuff.
Actually, the Wayans brothers was who I was thinking of when I asked that question. Oh, so yeah. Go me.
Yes. Perfect. And the influence of blaxploitation can be seen in the stories of the future black filmmakers that grew up with it.
Right.
So films about urban life would see a huge, huge fucking resurgence, but with a significantly more serious tone and a much broader appeal. Do the Right Thing and Boys in the Hood are prime examples of this, actually. So Spike Lee, of course, coming up from that, and then John Singleton. And I fucking love those films. And of course, Will Smith's character in The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air fucking idolizes John Shaft, and he does it for a fucking reason.
Yeah.
So as down and out as this shit was, the influence
was, it reached, the impact was made.
It reached a lot of, you know, young black people who wanted to be creatives. And finally saw themselves represented on screen. And they saw it in the exploitation genre, but they, when they had the chance to finally come up and make their own films, guess what? Some of these elements translate to it because that's a very powerful thing.
Right.
Even as a kid, if I saw a Latino on screen, it blew my goddamn mind. Like, I literally would be like, that last name sounds a little like my last name. Who's this character? I empathize now. Like, it's hard. It's hard to sometimes, like, just see everything as the default and know you're not it. And then when you finally see it, it feels really good.
Yeah, that's something that I obviously, like, growing up, I took for granted as a white person. Like, and I didn't, like, come, like, I didn't issue anything about seeing myself, like, wasn't until significantly later in life when I already was so used to just seeing white people because I'm white, you know?
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate because it also, I feel like that kind of leads, like, why representation is so important is that it not only does it give younger people the opportunity to see themselves, but it also helps younger white people see that they're not the default.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That they shouldn't be the default.
Well, that everybody has a different default.
Right.
People have a different default.
Exactly.
For sure.
And I think that's super cool. And I think that, I mean, you know, I think that's what's so important about representation. Because it does something for both, you know, for white people and people of color.
Mm-hmm. And Black Halo was a big contributor of this. This is very, very, because it's one of the most prominent touchstone blaxploitation films. And it came in really early when the genre was coming up. So it reached a lot of fucking people. But in terms of actual more on-the-nose blaxploitation stuff in more recent times, films like Action Jackson, Jackie Brown, Pootie Tang, Undercover Brother, and Black Dynamite would take the genre conventions established in the 70s and update them for modern times while honoring the legacy of blaxploitation. Particularly, Undercover Brother and Pootie Tang. I fucking love those movies. Have you not seen them? Have you seen any on this?
No.
Oh my god.
No. Nothing.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, those are
fucking
amazing.
I've heard of Jackie Brown.
Yeah, that's a Tarantino movie though. So I know you wouldn't be. Oh, it's the least Tarantino-y of the Tarantino, like, by far.
All right.
It's like a regular movie almost.
Interesting that Tarantino is directing films with anything related to blaxploitation, but sure.
I mean, you'll see it definitely in his Django and other filmmakers.
Well, I mean, he has an unhealthy urge to make white people say the N-word in his films.
he definitely has that fucking urge. But still, no blaxploitation horror hybrids made it, really. Though the last one was called Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde, and it was also directed by Blackula's own William Crane, who is now an owner of a very successful wedding videography business.
Really?
Yeah. He only had 4 films.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think one of them, like, was, like, pretty recent and does not have a link you can link out to, so it didn't probably make it that much. So it didn't do too great, but he did contribute to some pretty big stuff in film.
Yeah.
Which is nice. At least he had that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if he can support himself with the residuals and wedding videography, all power to you, buddy. But that's it. The legacy of blaxploitation, and, you know, it had its decline, but it did come back in certain ways.
Yeah.
Blaxploitation horror hybrids, however, not so much. But in terms of black filmmakers doing horror, you got motherfucking Jordan Peele from last week.
Right. So, and which means we are seeing, hopefully, what will soon be a renaissance of sorts for black horror, which I would love. Because we're, I mean, unfortunately, Jordan Peele is, like, getting all of, like, the hype from this. But I would love to see other, like, black directors give their take.
Yes.
Because, like, we're also seeing stuff with, like, you know, Spike Lee doing Black Klansman.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing, like, Boots Riley, who did Sorry to Bother You, which is not a conventional film by any stretch of the imagination. From what I understand, it's very, like, it's almost sci-fi.
Interesting. Okay, I gotta check it out.
Yeah. So,
I gotta check it out.
So, yeah. So, we're seeing a very cool upsweep in black films, mm-hmm. and black horror specifically, because of the success of Get Out.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to see other directors outside of Jordan Peele, because right now...
tackle horror.
Right, because right now Jordan Peele, like, is getting handed everything. Like, mm-hmm. he's doing Candyman, he's doing Us, he's doing Twilight Zone. Like, they are just, like, giving him everything right now.
Well, no,
which is great, and I'm very excited, because I do love Get Out, so I'm mm-hmm. excited to see what he does. And everything I've seen for Us is fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
My mom loved Get Out, but she's not gonna go see Us. Like,
no?
She's just, like,
too scared?
My mom hates horror.
Oh, right.
This is the whole...
Yeah.
This is the whole point of my childhood being what my childhood was. But
you made your way around.
I did.
You survived.
I did. I watched Last House on the Left in the privacy of my bedroom as a 16-year-old being horrified.
Oh, that's awesome. But overall, when it comes to the actual film Blackula, now that we're going to discuss it, what'd you think?
I liked it. I liked the music. I liked the lighting. The story, it was interesting. It just was kind of hard for me to follow.
Mm-hmm. It was. Yeah.
I kind of want to give it a rewatch because I did watch it very, very late and I mm-hmm. was really tired. So I had to rewatch the ending because I fell asleep.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed it. Like, I liked it more than I thought I was going to.
You know, I think I had the same impression because I wasn't too excited about it, though I was more interested in, like, the background and, like, why, because I, you know, heard of Blackula growing up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finally saw it, I'm like, okay, it's a blaxploitation film and it's a vampire film.
Yeah.
And it does some pretty cool stuff with the look. I do like Mambowalde, though.
I like the special effects.
Yeah, special effects are pretty good.
Like, I wanted to bring that up because it had a $500,000 budget. And they were able to do some pretty cool special effects with that budget. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, and it was actually shot not bad either. Like, you know, it's paced pretty good, I guess. I mean, it's paced like a movie, you know? Not some cheap movie. It's paced like... okay, this is like a $2 million film. Like,
well, right. That's the point that, you know, I was kind of talking about earlier about how the film ended up, like, it's a B-list horror, no doubt, but mm-hmm. it takes itself seriously enough that I would go so far as to call it a B-plus horror film.
Yeah, definitely. Especially within the genre that it's within.
At the time?
Yes.
Absolutely. In comparison to everything else that was coming out at the time, absolutely, I'd say it's a B-plus horror film.
No, makes total sense. And then what do you think of William Marshall's depiction of Blackula, and what does the origin of his character add to the film?
So and we talked about this kind of briefly earlier, but I loved that
mm-hmm.
he was kind of able, and they were receptive to his feedback about giving him more, kind of the opportunity to make changes to his character, because if they wanted him to just be some, like, Joe Schmo from down the street or whatever,
mm-hmm.
I feel like it would have had a different impact,
yeah.
I think, because in this storyline, you're seeing a prominent, wealthy, successful black character who then gets turned into a vampire because he doesn't want to let Dracula basically, like, imprison him and mm-hmm. rape his wife.
Yeah. And he's also an African.
Yeah.
Like, he's from Africa. And it's one of those things where he's just like, that's still a big part of him in the movie. It's like a point of pride as he continues along.
Like, he is...
He takes ownership of it. And mm-hmm. it's just like, no, this is me. This is me.
Yeah.
So, and I'm gonna bite the fuck out of you.
Yeah, he's like, no, fuck this. And he still has that, like, sense of royalty. Like,
yes,
he's
very, royalty, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a lot of royal, like, he acts royal. He acts, mm-hmm. you know, like, entitled, as a royal person would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, he's just like, no, you look just like my dead wife,
so... Oh, that's right. That poor girl is like, everybody's feeding her like, he's a dangerous guy and he's killing people. She's like, but I love him.
I'm like, when? How? Why?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Like, a love and a... It's more obsession. Very brief obsession.
I'm just like, you love him? You just met him.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a cape. I mean, that's also, like, my response to, like, every Disney movie ever. I'm just like, you just met him.
Which, as much as I... don't really care too much for Frozen, at least that was the funny part of it, where she was like, yeah, that princess shit's stupid.
Well, you know, it's funny, I've only seen that movie once.
I have a niece that came out during, she was born and raised during the time of its apex, so I've seen that movie a shit fucking ton, a lot of times.
My sister is very into Mulan right now, which is great.
That's a good one to have. That's a good one to like. I can dig that.
It was Mulan and something else that she's into right now, I forget. But, anyway, it's going to bug me. But anyway, looking back at the film, are there any characterizations that can be seen as problematic in today's day and age?
Yes. Yes, there is. Do you know which one it is?
Not the characterizations. I was more like, not offended, but I was like affronted by the casual use of calling people the F slur.
Yes. Yeah. And I think even the two gay characters that they have in this film, I feel like they're treated very disrespectfully, yeah, like big time. They're like,
yeah,
these aren't people to us.
Yeah, like even the police, like even if one of the men was black, like the main character was just like, ah, fuck them.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
like they're gay. Like, F slur. These F slurs. Like, what?
Like, we're not gonna look too much into the crimes around these guys. Like, which I mean, it's emblematic of the 70s because obviously, like, that stuff is still way more contentious now.
Yeah. Like, well, I mean, also, the 70s is an interesting time because you're exiting Free Love, but you're also getting into disco. Mm-hmm. And disco and, like, gay culture, there's a lot going on there. Mm-hmm. And it's very, not segregated, but, like, it's before, it's this very interesting time where, like, it was before the AIDS crisis, so people, like, gay people were very, like, out and open and, like, whatever, fuck you kind of, mm-hmm, like, type of deal.
Yeah. And the poor establishment was just like, you guys,
yeah,
are people? Why are,
yeah,
you acting
kind
like regular people, not subservient, you know, whatever.
Like, they were
kind of,
like, clutching their pearls over, mm-hmm, the whole thing. So it's very interesting to see that and to see that through the framework of someone who, because I was a gender and sexuality studies major, my ability to watch film or to analyze film in college was strictly limited to
that lens,
like LGBT film. Mm-hmm. So all the film classes I was able to take as a gender and sexuality studies major was, mm-hmm, limited to just like gay film.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so it's very interesting to see it from that perspective and to kind of analyze it from that background.
Nice. No, that's a very, very good point. And of course, as with your major, I'm very happy that you're employed. Because that don't happen.
You know what, all the gender and sexuality study majors I know for the most part are employed.
That's
not
good.
Not from, like, I mean, not in our particular paths, but also, like, I didn't go
pretty
to
good
grad
paths.
School. Yeah,
pretty
I,
good
I didn't go to grad school,
yeah,
so, which is fine, and I have no interest in going to grad school. I just did when,
yeah,
I was in undergrad.
Well, one of my majors was communication. I remember where he's like, those people don't get jobs. All the communication majors I remember from college, they work amazing jobs right now.
Yeah.
I'm like, holy shit, you guys are fucking wrong, son.
Technically, we work amazing jobs. We just have awful bosses.
Huh? So not on the podcast, Alex. But you're right.
Like, they listen to the podcast.
Yeah, yeah, good point. What does Blackula say about black culture in the 70s, though? I think we talk about this a lot in the history.
Yeah.
Because it's still pretty repressed, I think. You're coming post-civil rights here. But there's still a level of ownership here that they're like, I'm going to take hold of these stereotypes and these things that you want to put on us,
yeah,
and we're
going
to glorify this bitch because it's, you know, you want to use that to put us down, we're going to build up from it. How about fucking that?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer to this because, like, I don't want to base my entire perspective, because, like I said, I don't watch a lot of 70s films. I don't. The 70s is not my decade of choice, necessarily. So
yeah.
I don't listen to a lot of music from the 70s. I don't watch a lot of movies from the 70s. So this is pretty much the only thing I have to compare it to. So I don't want to make any, like, generalizations about what black culture was in the 70s, because, mm-hmm, I don't know enough about it.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it seems very, like, in the similar vein that is blaxploitation.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that it's very, like, it seemed kind of, like, community-based,
mm-hmm,
and it seemed to have, like, a lot of, I don't know, just, like, how all the characters were black, they all hung out with, like, other black people, white, mm-hmm, people were kind of the butt of the joke, which was great, because, yeah, like, there was that other cop in the movie who, mm-hmm, they were just like, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
The whole time, and I was just like, love that, but.
But, I mean, I also look at it, like, exploitation is provocative,
yeah,
in its essence. So in order to create, you know, a discussion, it does something very provocative that anybody in the establishment who wants to counter it has to look further into it.
Yeah.
If they really, really want to say something, mm-hmm, of meaning. Which means that that provocation and then their ability to look into it might change their fucking mind the further they look into it. That's what the exploitation is. It's a punch to the face.
Yeah.
Why did you get punched in the face?
Yeah. No, totally. And I'll ask you this question because I already answered. What other blaxploitation or blaxploitation style films do you enjoy, Anthony Fuentes? Feel free to gush as much as possible.
Undercover Brother and Pootie Tang, like I said earlier, are fucking amazing, amazing takes on this. Pootie Tang, I understand, is not... The finalized film is not exactly what it was intended to be. It was intended to be much more of a direct blaxploitation film, actually. But I also like Jackie Brown, too. So, I don't know. And then Black Dynamite, damn. Yeah, so there's a lot of, I think, contemporary takes or things that use a lot of influence from blaxploitation that I actually really, really enjoy. And it's shit that I grew up with. And then I also watched just a lot of black comedies growing up, which has some... a lot of references to... this kind of stuff.
My family, in true white people fashion, didn't think that they could watch black comedies because they thought it was, like, by poking fun at racist stuff, and if they laughed at it, it would make them racist.
Oh, what? That's so weird.
It's weird white person logic, but it's just, like, it's one of those things, and I was raised with it, and it took forever for me to deconstruct, and that's why I didn't watch a lot of black comedies growing up.
You missed Friday, you missed Double Take.
I did not watch White Chicks until college.
Damn. So you missed Scary Movie.
Oh, yeah. My mom was like...
Don't Be a Menace.
Yeah.
And...
I watched... Fuck. DJ sat me down and was like, you're watching Don't Be a Menace.
Yes.
And I was just like, okay.
Dude.
And I loved it. It was very funny. Yeah. I enjoyed it. I was just
but
like...
But it's like... I feel like it's also like the wrong lesson to take because...
Totally.
You know, these movies, they should have broad appeal. People,
right.
You know...
They're made for everyone. They just happen to... like anyone can watch them basically. Like,
yeah.
Sure, like if they're made like for black audiences, that doesn't mean white people can't watch it.
And they can't enjoy it, and you might learn something watching it. You just might, you know, you never know.
So it's interesting that that's how my, like, I don't know, or that's how I interpreted it.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't outwardly really discuss race a whole lot in my family growing up.
No, that makes sense.
But that's kind of how I interpreted it growing up, and I could be corrected on this later by my family, but who knows?
Mm-hmm. We'll see, because I feel like growing up, in, like, the neighborhoods that I did when I was younger. And then, of course, moving to the suburbs and being one of the limited amount of minorities in these classes and things. Me and the black students got along real well. And there's a lot of overlap in culture between affected communities in the Latino and black community. You'll hear it a lot in hip-hop, too.
Yeah.
Because they'll say my Latino partners and shit like that. Because we grew up with a lot of the same shit. Like, it really is. Like, it, I mean, you know, not everybody, obviously.
Right,
because
there's, like, there's
but Southern California.
Right, between, like, racism, like, you know, racism and anti-blackness and, like, yeah, no, that makes sense.
But
and then anti-blackness within Mexican communities or Latino communities.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, you can only, there's so very limited amount of Latino films. There's a significantly smaller amount of those than there are black films. There just is.
And from what I understand with that, that happens a lot. Or that I can only theorize that a lot of that came from a lot of immigrants, like, really wanting to integrate into white society.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, wanting to just, like, be, quote unquote, be like white people. So there wasn't, like, a whole lot of, like, wanting to create, like,
this is our culture
type thing. Which isn't to say that's all, you know, the whole thing, but that's from what I've seen in discussions and stuff.
But then also, what would you like to see? And this is going to be the last question, guys.
Yeah.
What would you like to see in a modern blaxploitation horror hybrid?
Oh, geez. I don't know, because I don't have enough experience in any of them, really, to have a definitive answer.
I want to see a David Fincher crime drama, but in a blaxploitation lens.
Yeah.
It would be awesome. With all the rules. All the rules put in here, but give it that Fincher, like...
Oh my god, that's amazing. I would love to see that.
Yeah, I mean, and don't give it to Fincher, but somebody who can, like, pull off a Fincher-esque film. I would love to see that with the crime stuff.
I would
love
that.
Because, you know, crime dramas are actually a big part of blaxploitation also.
No, and I love me a crime drama, so...
And you can make it horror by really emphasizing the nastiness of the crimes and things like that. And then also, let's see. Nah, see, Jordan Peele's doing a lot of good stuff with this stuff, so... I can't think of anything much else besides that can hybrid these two things nowadays.
Yeah, I know. Especially now. Like, I think it's just really hard because of how horror has kind of taken such a different turn. It's coming back to the political, mm-hmm. where it's, like, very, very vividly and, like, explicitly political, like, Get Out. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we're quite there yet for there to be, like, a modern blaxploitation mm-hmm. in the way that Blackula is a blaxploitation film.
Exactly. No, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I think, which is unfortunate, but also I think it's good to let, you know, things be that in the past.
That have evolved in the genre anyway, so we're fine. We're fine.
Yeah. So, is there any other final thoughts or anything you wanted to add before, like, anything else about the film?
I mean, the movie itself was okay. Yeah. I feel like I was, like, a little in and out. I mean, it's just, I feel more of a relic than it is, like, a mm-hmm. great film. But I like parts of it a lot.
Do you think you'd benefit from rewatching it?
Yes. I think if I had a better stream to watch it on, because I watched it on some shitty Vimeo thing.
Yeah, you watched it on, like, Vimeo, right?
These, like, three assholes were dressed up and, like, stopped. Like, where commercial breaks would be, they'd go in and give their little, ha-ha, how funny that was, kind of, like, thing. It was, like, their own little show they were
trying
to create.
That's disgusting.
It was stupid. It was stupid. So,
for those of you who aren't Anthony and Google things, Blockula is streaming on Amazon Prime if you have it or know someone who has it.
Google failed me.
Yeah.
Google failed me like a motherfucker.
So feel free to check that out. I would recommend watching it. I think it's a great glimpse into 70s horror and blaxploitation.
Yeah, that's actually a good way of putting it. It is a good amalgamation of those two things.
And I think it has, you know, especially because it did come out in 1972, it has a great sort of introduction to blaxploitation and show the stepping stones to what it eventually became. Mm-hmm. And I really like that blaxploitation, we kind of were able to mention how responses to blaxploitation is what gave us the black comedies, like mm-hmm. from the Wayans brothers and everything that we got in the, you know, late 90s, 2000s, you mm-hmm. know, 2010s, stuff
absolutely.
Like that. So I think that's it on my end. Thank you everyone for joining us. I think, that's it. And then
we only
for
got one more movie this month.
We have one more week left already of Black History Month.
Yeah.
We hope, you know, you've all been enjoying the films. At the time that we're recording this, Get Out hasn't come out yet, but we hope you enjoyed Get Out.
Yes.
It was very fun, and I hope you all didn't tear us a new one for.
And if you did, we're just not going to acknowledge it for weeks.
So thank you everyone for joining us. As always, if you like what you heard, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Jesus, sorry.
Get your shit together, Webster.
I know, we're almost done. Don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts as well. If you feel so inclined, you can find us on all of the social media horse shit.
good way of putting it. I like that.
Our Twitter is @horrorpeoplepod. We're on Facebook on Horror People Pod. We don't use it yet, though.
Yeah.
Sorry, getting on that. And then you can find us on Instagram @ Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORRORBLE People's Podcast. And then if you also want to follow us in our day-to-day lives, it's not very horror related, but you totally can if you want. Mm-hmm. You can follow Anthony Fuentes @ Hyrulean Hustler on Instagram. And you can find me, Alex Webster, at Instagram @ The Blonde Dictionary. And you can find me on Twitter @ Ghost Coffee Shop.
There we go. And then also, I remember in a previous episode, I promised that we'd start off March with a play-by-play. That's done. Not going to work anymore.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because, just as an explanation, there's been one movie that I've been waiting for a screening to happen so I can show Alex this film.
Jesus Christ.
I've been waiting for it. I'm like, as soon as this movie is in theaters, we're going to go and we're going to cover and just scratch whatever the next one on our list was. That's going to kick off March because it's also a mindfuck of a film.
Yeah.
And part of a film movement that I badly want to explore. So
we still have one more film for February. We're not getting too ahead of ourselves. Mm-hmm. But just to keep in mind, March is Anthony's birthday mandate. So
I like that.
He picked all of the films for March. I had no say. I was just like, do what your heart tells you.
It's gonna be a broad one. Yeah, no, it's not gonna be broad at all. It's gonna be pretty niche.
Yeah, so
enjoy
we're
that.
We're covering a lot of niche horror, and we're gonna be talking about some fucked up shit because Anthony has a fucked up sense of what's good.
Although we do get one franchise, don't worry,
yes,
guys. You'll have
we
have one lifesaver.
one thing. If you know, and then unless you're just gonna not listen for a month, which would make me sad. So
don't do that. You'll love it. Trust me.
Yeah, you know you'll like it. So that's it for this week. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. listening, and we will catch you on the next one.
Peace out, you fuckers.
Bye, guys.